Welcome to Book Club for Movies, everybody. It's February 28th. I'm Ryan Miller, and sniffing for me like a vampire bat for a horse with a nick on its ear so he can suck on, it's Matt Amberg.
It's a really great line that's so convoluted that you have to think about it, and you're like, yeah, okay, that tracks.
Are you kidding? It took me like 4 rewatches just to write it all down correctly.
I bet.
On Book Club for Movies, where we talk about one movie every week, and you watch it, and you let us know, and then we talk about what you talk about, so we talk about it.
Let's talk about it.
All right. This week, it's Brick. Rian Johnson's, I still haven't looked up whether or not it's his first, but it's one of his earliest movies here.
It is his first.
Is it? Okay.
It is.
It's really good for a first.
Yeah, he comes out of the gates, swings big.
Does he
hit a home run? Ground rule double? Is it a bunt?
Cake?
Maybe
we should synopsize it first before we find out.
What? Sorry, I was thinking about Cake, the band.
Aren't we all? How about a synopsis?
You want me to do a synopsis for Brick? All right, I'll do one. Let's try it. It'll go something like this. Brick, going to come at you in 1 hour and 50 minutes, written and directed by Rian the Last Jedi Johnson. Starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Lucas Haas, Emily D. Ravine, and Nora Zehitner. Here is your book club for movies. Synopsis for Brick by Rian Last Jedi Johnson.
Okay, all right.
After an alarming phone call from his ex-girlfriend leads him to finding her body in a sewage tunnel, teenage loner Brendan forces himself to delve further into hated cliques, drugs, and high school crime rings to find out who murdered Emily and why. So, before we go too far, I gotta bring this up. When Rian Johnson wrote the script, was her name Emily, or was he like, we're going to name her Emily after Emily D. Ravine from Lost, and it's just easier so that you don't have to worry about your name?
So many questions. What? So somebody else is named Emily. Oh, is it the same actress? It is the same actress,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And do you remember her from Lost? She was in Lost.
Vaguely.
She was in Lost. She loved Charlie.
Okay.
Not Penny's boat.
Oh, what? She was in charge of Not Penny's boat?
No, that was Penny.
Wait, she was Penny?
No, she was not Penny. She was on the island. She was the one who had the baby.
Sometimes I think Lost was a little convoluted.
Only for you. I'm totally tracking here.
You know what's not convoluted, and I will stand by this, is Brick. And I came to this thing... where did I hear? But this came to me in the same breath, I feel like, as Blue Ruin, which we talked about semi-recently and probably not for long enough.
No, not at all. But I love that movie and continue.
But it's one of those movies, an earlier example of a director that's knocking everything seemingly out of the park nowadays. But other than that, I didn't know much about Brick. I want to say I had heard something about it that made zero sense. It didn't help me at all anyways.
Can I guess what that thing was?
All right. Sure. Yes.
Did it have to do with that it was a 40s, 50s, pulpy crime, hard-boiled detective movie, but set in high school in current present day?
It did.
Something
along
those lines.
That's what made zero sense to me. So yeah, it didn't really help me at all. But yes, and even then I want to say, didn't it completely solve everything for me? Like, you still got to get used to this movie in some respects, I would say.
I think this is a movie that you benefit from understanding what it's, and I don't mean this reductively. This is not reductive, but
we've already established that anytime you say that, it is reductive.
It's always reductive. I think this serves better if you understand what it's a love letter to, what it's aping in so many ways, because it does pull strongly from hard-boiled detective movies. That's what it is, from the 40s and 50s.
Right, film noir, you know. But in fact, this is not secret stuff. You know, Johnson has stated his influences being the Maltese Falcon and other Dashiell Hammett novels and stuff like that. And yeah, I would say if you're unfamiliar with that, this movie's going to make a whole lot of no sense to you in just amazing ways. But even then, I want to say, because I'm not completely unfamiliar with that stuff, although it has been a while since I've got into the film noir chapter of my film, but I still have all my textbooks. We can talk about that later. But it still took some getting used to for me, I guess.
It's anachronistic in the way it unfolds, and so it can be jarring because you're seeing things
that are not tropes we're used to seeing anymore, filmed in a way we're not used to seeing anymore.
Yeah, and you've explained that by saying that it is basically one of those stories, you know, transplanted into a high school setting. I don't think it's hard to also see why he would have done something like that. I think there are a number of reasons for that, and we'll get into it. But once you get past that anachronism, maybe, once you get past that mashup, there is so much to enjoy here, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
And I think where we do need to game plan this a little bit, again, some people do this before the tape begins rolling. Some people don't record on tapes either.
Well, you know what? We like to do a lot of things backwards.
Yeah, anachronistically.
Yes, exactly. This is my my Maxell tape needs to be flipped over here in a minute.
This is a complicated, not convoluted. Again, I'll still stand by that, but it is complicated. So whereas usually we do kind of get into the A to B, I think we can still do that, but I think it would be easy to get into the weeds with that. So we're going to try to not do that, but I also think that it's going to be hard to get around at times. Because the story is so much of what this is.
Yeah, okay. So I think I know where you're going with this. There is a lot to this movie, and you're right, it can get complicated. It's such a weird movie, though, because it's also fairly straightforward. Like, it's a very linear narrative that branches into these different paths that all converge back into the end of the narrative. And it works in such a great way that digging through every minute of this, yes, it's going to be a little hard, and that will actually make it more convoluted than it actually is.
And I think this is why I'm so glad I watched it two times. I went through it again this time to get up to date on it, because I had already watched it when we first talked about maybe doing it.
Yeah.
Because so much more not only comes out, but also I took two separate chunks of notes here. One of them is just the chronology, because I wanted to make sure I got that. And in so doing, I picked up on like a zillion more things that I kind of glossed over because, and I'll say this up front, not only is it written like a film noir, you know, like one of those pulpy movies or novels of that time, but it's a really well-written one of those. Like for all he says about not wanting to compete with that, I mean, I could see why they would do it in high school because one, it adds a freshness to it. Like I absolutely don't think they should have done it in, you know, classic as a period piece or whatever.
Right, right.
But number two, it's way more practical to do it this way. Like he didn't have to worry about, you know, all of that stuff. And the fact that he kind of did this on what's probably a shoestring budget for Hollywood. I mean, after he got somebody to give him any money for it, it seems. But I almost don't even care about that. Like it works so well alone, like the script period, yeah. It could totally go toe to toe with any of those other stories, in my opinion.
Sure.
Like it's tight. It's written really, really well.
It's written really well. And a huge portion of why this works so well in the way it does is how he builds the archetypes, and that there are those like he does a really fantastic job of taking the archetypes from those movies, those stories, and turning them into people everybody can kind of identify with at that point. Because those hard-boiled novels, those detective stories, they're really cool to read. They're really cool to fun. They're really cool to fun. Huh.
They are cool to fun.
They are really cool to read. They're really cool to fun. They're really cool to watch. They're also fun to watch and really cool when, in any case,
wow.
This is, I think this is fun because it takes those archetypes, puts them into a position that we've all been in. And in terms of, you know, high school existence, not necessarily hunting down murders, But it makes those archetypes something we've all seen. Like we know all of those people. Like we know all of them. And it's cool because it does make it slightly more relatable than maybe the Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, yeah, also no, yeah.
Okay, let's get into this more, because we've talked too much about nothing.
Okay, so chronologically, at least in the broadest sense of the word, you've already mentioned how it is about this our protagonist, Brendan.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
JGL.
JGL, correct.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
He got him.
Who has had a past relationship with a girl he's broken up with. She has gone astray somewhat, but she's also not the femme fatale.
No, she is not.
Who is actually Laura, who comes in a little bit later into the film. But Brendan tasks himself with essentially finding out where Emily went wrong or why she went wrong. They do meet up and they do get to talk before she does turn up dead. But yeah, he basically tasks himself with trying to figure out what happened. And that's the essential mystery of it. But also where I think this kind of deviates from most film noir out there, from most of these stories, is that Brendan is kind of a preternatural detective that weaves his own web. Because, and think about, for some reason, this is the example that comes most to mind because it's the one I feel like that uses the tropes specifically and purposefully. But It's a Wonderful Life. Literature on that tells you that it's a Christmas movie shoehorned into a film noir. And why that is because the protagonist is usually someone who is experienced in the world, you know, is worldly in a way, but still has kind of these, sometimes they're portrayed as outmoded ideals or something like that.
Right.
But eventually what happens is that protagonist will get lost within the web of lies, as it were, you know, whose web might be up for grabs at some point. I think what's interesting about this story in particular is that Brendan creates his own web around all of this that, yeah, appears to spin out of control. To what degree is always in question. That's part of the mystery. But the fact that he's the one creating it is, I think, a little singular amongst these stories. And it's also done so incredibly well that I'm just going to go on and on about it forever until you stop me.
You have a thought that's continuing. I was waiting. I'm not going to interrupt you on this.
But that's I think, where this story stands out. And a lot of it can be encapsulated in that without us getting into the weeds.
Sure.
There are a number of characters that come in. They do. One of them is a femme fatale. Laura is already kind of that world. There are drugs. One of my favorite tossed off characters is Brad Bramish.
Brad Bramish.
Who's this total, like, full of bravado. Like, he's a jock.
He's a meathead.
He only has, I think, maybe two lines, and he just repeats them at different points. And at first, this is one thing that completely sailed by me the first time I watched this, but it's because he's completely drugged out both times. And there's a subtle hint. There's a little sniff when he first meets him at the party, and he's wearing a toga, and he's going on about, if you're not going to put Brad Bramish in the game, you know, that whole thing, which is same thing he says later when, again, he's hopped up on whatever. I didn't make the connection that, yeah, that's how he gets to the pin, the kingpin, is by going toe-to-toe with Brad Bramish, but Brad Bramish was a sap.
Which, by the way,
he was just the pin's biggest buyer.
I want to point out two things that you just mentioned. The fact that there's a terminology thing. When have you ever heard a high schooler say, what a sap? It fits in with what he would say, but it's totally, that's a language throwback, right? Like, that's something that you would hear in the 40s and 50s. The other thing I just wanted to point out is, he keeps saying how you got to put Brad Bramish in the game.
Got to put him in the game.
But the reason he's probably not in the game is because he's so hopped up on drugs.
Right. Yeah.
So this, jumping back a minute though, to the web thing that you were talking about. I think what's interesting about this movie too, is that I kind of can see what you're saying and agree with that he weaves his own web, but I also think that, again, those archetypes are built in such a way that he has all those things that you would see in any other movie. But they're broken out in such a unique way that pinpointing them becomes a little more of a chore, I think. Not in a bad way, but it's like you got to really think about it. But if you break down all of the clicks that he goes to, those are all those characters that you'd find that are those characters in those movies, those stories. And they're never the most important people, but they always have some of the most important information, and they were always somebody from their past. And that, you know, that goes with the drama kids. He knows all the drama kids, but he doesn't want to deal with the drama kids. He didn't even want to deal with his friend Brain, the guy who knows everything, his version of Q. They haven't even been talking for a while. You know, he's like, and so it's a really fun exploration of you know, an iteration, if you would maybe think.
I will. You
horrific.
Can't stop me.
I won't.
I mean, and like I said, it speaks to Rian Johnson's love of that stuff. But yeah, he takes it all and makes it his own and improves upon it and does just a freaking great one of those.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know how you still write that so well today, or whenever this was made, 2005. But a couple of the ones I did grab, one of them was that one I introduced you with. But there's another one where after he finds Emily's dead body, he goes back to Brain, who is his confidant, is his teammate in a lot of ways, but is also his tool, kind of. His name is literally Brain, right?
That's the nickname. Yeah, that's what they call him. Yeah.
All right. So that should tell you most of what you need to know right there.
Yeah. He's the informant, right?
He's the contacts.
But he's like, the Watson to Holmes.
There you go. There you go. But he goes back to talk to him about it, and Brain doesn't know that Emily's dead, but knows that Brendan had gone out to find her, and all Brendan says to him about her is that she's gone. Yeah. And the Brain responds, couldn't raise her? And he just kind of looks down and says, no, I couldn't. If you told me he was stealing these lines from the best one of these, I would believe you.
It's great dialogue.
And then the other one was when he's also speaking with... The Brain gets a lot of the good lines in this movie, actually.
Brain's a great character. He's in the movie minimally, but every scene he's in is integral.
But they're trying to break down some of the phone call he got from Emily in the first place to figure out what actually happened to her, right? And Brain's, they have like a number of words, and he's giving them to the Brain to see if they ring any bells, you know, because he's got all the info. And he says, pin. And he's like, the pin? Like Kingpin? He's like, okay. He's like, I thought that was just a spook story, you know, that dealers used to instill fear or something like that. And Brain says, see, the pin pipes it from the lowest scrapper to Brad Bramish himself. Maybe. I mean, ask any doper right where the junk's spraying, and they'll say they scraped it off that, who scored it off this, who bought it off someone. After four or five connections, the list always ends with the pin. I make it sound easy, but no, I don't. But the whole movie is just line after line of that stuff, and you just eat it up. Like, I don't know, maybe if you're not a fan of this stuff, which I already am, maybe you're less into it, but I just... Every second I'm like, oh, that was fantastic.
It's good. It's really good. And I think that something else that needs to get said here is that because of that, and Rian Johnson knows this, there are enough moments of levity in here that are like, some of them are actually laugh out loud worth a chuckle. Like there are a couple of bits in here where you just kind of have to laugh because it fits in the context of the entire story. It makes sense in the context of the story. And yet it's still really funny. And we'll get to that stuff in a bit. But,
but like right now, because you just, it's perfect.
Well, perfect.
So
let's do it.
Entire first half of this film, you may giggle at some things. Again, you may, as you get used to the mashup, smile at some things. But I think the movie itself is played for zero laughs for at least the first 45 minutes of it.
Sure. I'll give you that.
Until he connects with the Kingpin.
Yep.
And they're in his house.
Yep.
And then it allows itself some levity where the mom is going through the, like they're upstairs in the Kingpin's home as the mom
is
goes through the
him
fridge.
Apple juice. Well, but before we even get to that, and it is the pin that there's all the, like the, a lot of levity starts with the pin. Brendan is kidnapped. He's tossed in the back of this car. That he's been kind of seeing over and over again, and he knows it's related, but he doesn't know how it's related to Emily's death, but he knows. He finally figures out a way to get to see the pin because he knows this guy's going to get him there. He gets tossed into the back of this guy's trunk. The back of the trunk, he jimmies the thing open so he can figure out exactly where the pin lives. So we see the pin lives in this like kind of normal house in a normal neighborhood.
I mean, the whole thing was shot in San Clemente, California, I believe. So,
and we are immediately cut from him being pulled out of the car to this basement. And this basement's kind of lined with people. And it's very 70s. But you're like, okay. All right. So this
wood
is...
Wood paneling.
There's wood paneling. The flooring is like bright orange, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. He goes in. He meets Laura again, and Laura's kind of mentioned, and she's the femme fatale, and he meets the pin, and we find out the pin is Lucas Haas, which is just the funniest thing, because Solar Babies is amazing. So we have that conversation, and then they go upstairs. The next shot is they're upstairs. They're sitting around a breakfast table, a dinner table, while his mom, the Pin's mother, is rummaging through the refrigerator. Well, I don't think I have any orange juice, but I've got some apple juice, while Brendan is sitting there like eating a bowl of cereal.
Yep.
and the entire time the mom is just very like, and the Pin is sitting across from him in this black jacket. He's got his cane and his, the guy who brought him there is all muscular behind him and is all like, you know, being the bodyguard. Tug.
That's Tug.
And it is just the most,
which may actually be Doug, but I don't care. I'm going to call him
no,
Tug.
No, it's Tug.
Okay, good.
And it's the most ridiculous, and you just have to laugh about it. And that
is played for laughs. That is purposeful.
Totally. And the thing with that is, though, while it's played for laughs for us, it's so well shot and put together because it's not played for laughs by the characters.
No.
You know, like, and those are moments that when those are written right and those are portrayed right, they're just perfect. They're so perfect for movies like this. And again, everybody just kind of kills that whole scene.
Which is why I think it's in there. I think after they came up with this entire idea, you know, and he kind of realized what it was going to be, you have to put that scene in there.
Oh, sure.
You know, I'm glad you can't put that at the beginning of the movie because that would have honestly, you know, tainted the whole thing. So yeah, it's halfway in. They know what this thing is at this point, and they're like, okay, we can do this scene. But because they also pull it back just as quickly. Like, it gets, if anything, more serious after that.
Sure. There are a couple of other moments that did make me laugh, and they always will.
For sure. Yeah.
But yeah, for the most of the movie is, it's, I also want to point out, it's not melodramatic, like in some of those ways, in like the, this is melodrama in that perfect, like I got to find this dame. I don't know where she is, but I'm going to find her. I'm on her trail. It's it's just not self-serious. That's the thing. It's not like, it doesn't sit there and try to elevate itself to be this Oscar winning dramatic piece or anything. It's
no. And I think that comes with the territory. Yeah.
Right. It knows what it is, and it does the best it can do with what it is because that's great.
It does do the best because it's great.
Mm-hmm.
Should have been a tagline for it.
Well, I think he used it for Looper.
Oh, man.
So I will also say that the, one of the other moments is, and I think you'll have to check the timing on this. I cannot remember. I can't remember if it's before or after that.
I've got it. Okay. I pulled out the Brick chronology notes. What do you got?
He realizes he's being chased by somebody that tries to stab him. Comes after, tries to kill it. And he starts
Chuck,
running.
I believe is his name.
And he starts running through the school. And he's like, he's booking and booking and booking. And he's running through the school. And he's being chased by a guy with a knife. And I cannot help but laugh at how that sequence ends. Because he's okay, running, yeah, he's yeah. running, he's running, he's running. He cuts around a corner, pops his shoes off so that he, because it's silent, like there's nothing going on around him. You just hear his shoes running. He takes off his shoes and then jumps out right from the corner where he hears the guy coming down the, he hears him coming after him. He jumps out from the corner, slides in front of him. The guy takes a trip, and it's the way this is shot that's so perfect. The camera is focused on Joseph Gordon-Levitt in this like it's a shot from his perspective, like behind him with the wall, and then he slides out and this guy trips over him. The camera pulls back to that same shot where he's now on the ground, and you just hear a clang from the guy taking a header into a metal post.
Yep.
I just can't help but laugh at it.
It's great.
It's a serious moment. And then Joseph Gordon-Levitt gets up, looks at him, and like pushes him with his, and then just walks away. Like, all right.
Well, he takes his wallet out. And
he takes his wallet, right.
Number one, this movie does some great things with perspective.
I forgot about that. He takes his wallet out.
We can't even get into, but that's cool that you mentioned that. Number two, since you asked, that comes at the moment in the story where he has met with the Pin and basically fed him this story over that bowl of cereal about how he became not a patsy, which I feel like is a word that could have been used anywhere in this film.
He was an informant.
And yes, for the VP, who are basically like the cops, you know, in fact, I want to say he calls them that at some point.
He does. Yeah, he refers to them as cops.
But it was something that happened in the past that he was able to use in speaking with the Pin to make it look like he was in a good spot to not only help the pin, but help the VP if he wanted to. So it's like this semi, I want to work for you because I'm valuable, or I'm going to blow up your whole operation type thing. And after that, he's like, okay, we'll let you know in about a day. So when that guy walks up on him about to stab him, it's when he's waiting to hear the verdict from the pin, because he's like, we'll either hire you or we'll rub you, is what he says. So when the guy comes up to stab him, he calls Brain. He's like, I got to know, because he got his wallet after he died, or after he died, after he got knocked out by the pole. He's like, I got to know who this guy is, because if it's from the pin, then it's over with and I got to get out of here or I'm dead. And but then a car pulls up right then that it is the pin, and he's like, well,
which, you know, by the way, another hilarious moment. The pin pulls up in this like van that has been hollowed out in the back so that he has a like a lamp with a very 70s lampshade. It's got fringe in the bottom of it, and he's got a whole he's got like a comfortable chair for him to sit in, and it's just
it's
such
a pin, man.
He's got his like 1976, you know, Astro van or whatever it was.
Ridiculous. I mean, the movie is smart about that. It knows what needs to be transplanted, because that's in the movies, that's a limo, right? You know, the pin is a millionaire who only goes everywhere in a limo, and he's sitting in the back, you know. So, right. Yes, this very smartly transplants things into places where, yes, you should definitely smile.
Well, and I mean, this is a case, of course, too, where I think you end up with the, it has to be in high school, because even if he was a millionaire, he lives in his mom's basement. He's borrowing his mom's car. You know, like he's a high schooler. Yeah, I've got a ton of money. I don't know what to do with it, but I'm not going to buy a car because that'll be weird.
Enough of that stuff is thrown in there, I guess, that it doesn't seem completely, you know, it is more of a mashup than a transplant, I guess, yeah. But yeah. It's done smartly, obviously.
Again.
Like we've said. And I don't know how much more I could say.
I think that this is one of those rare movies where us kind of giving you, like, I think we've been very repetitive probably here. This is probably one of the most repetitive things we've done. Not the humor through repetition. We didn't do the humor through repetition here. Humor through repetition was on a different show. We did mention humor through repetition on Zero Hit Points.
It's but Tuesday.
No humor through repetition here on purpose.
Not an ounce so far.
but I do think that this is a movie that benefits a little bit more from maybe having an understanding of where it's coming from at the start, but not knowing how this all kind of plays out, especially as it builds to the ending, because this movie has a tremendous buildup. And I think the ending here just sticks it in every respect.
Yep.
Like, it is a knockout of an ending that is satisfying for the viewer while being satisfying to some of the characters and not as satisfying to, it's just such a great the way that ends is when you talk about at the beginning of this show, when you talk about how Brendan weaves his own web, that part of the web when he has finally gotten to the end and he's putting on the finishing touches, so to speak, unbelievable. Like that when Rian Johnson wrote that section of the movie, that like that third act,
it's perfectly constructed, man. I mean, it's the perfect ending to a perfect script.
It
honestly
is.
And okay, here's the thing. Can you say a bad thing about this film? Because I'm struggling. I don't know if I have one bad thing I could say about this other than it benefits from repeated viewings. Is that a bad thing?
Yeah, there's not, you know, honestly, it's, I can see this movie being a difficult one for people. I can also see it being one that takes multiple viewings to pick up and go, okay, I do like that. I do have a hard time though with
what, like, about the performances? Anybody completely, I mean, it's hard in a film, like in a pulpy film noir thing, to be like, oh, this person kind of chews the scenery. It's more like, oh good, this person chewed the scenery.
No, and I think that everybody, especially given what the movie is, when it's taking place, everybody kind of does a great job. There are maybe some of the side characters, like, you know, maybe the guy, maybe Tug could have been a little different but those are all, that's really more flavor, I think, than the performance itself. Like, I think that's more of a, I don't like that guy, as opposed to he was bad. Okay. You know what I mean? I don't know.
I mean, maybe Kara, the drama girl.
Oh, but see, she's one of my favorite parts.
Mine too.
I love that character because of who she is. Like her analogy to those movies, she is the one that you kind of think, okay, maybe she is the femme fatale and she's going to come up later. But no, this other, she's got to be the femme fatale. How does she fit
Laura
in?
Laura's definitely the femme fatale.
And,
yeah.
No, but there are moments, at least for me, when I watch those movies where, yeah, you know, she's supposed to be it. What is she? Maybe she actually becomes the femme fatale at some point. Maybe Laura actually does get killed. Maybe. That character is, she's so great because she has all the information. She knows everything.
That's true, but she doesn't give anything.
But she doesn't give anything. And she is the character that is, you have the femme fatale, and then you've got this other character that is willing to pull the detective away from everything for her own reasons that may coincide with you know the antagonist. But she's such a good character. But she could have been fleshed out more. You know, I mean,
That's it. Worst part about this movie, there could be more of it.
Yes, that is it.
And that's Brick.
That is Brick.
9 stars.
Out of 6.
Accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Podcast at bookclubformovies.com. If you ever want to talk about it, we are at a crossroads here, Matt. Do you realize?
Okay.
In fact, we didn't talk about this on Tuesday. We're good at this.
Ish.
We are coming up on show 200 of Zero Hit Points next week. Also show 50 for Book Club for Movies next week.
That's right.
We haven't talked a darn thing about what we're going to do for these momentous occasions.
I think that I'll bring a party thing that goes woo and that,
okay, all right, number one, top of the list.
And then maybe one of those things that you pop and there's confetti.
Okay, I feel like these are mostly firework related.
Yeah, also fireworks. Mostly because of how visual this medium is. I figure if we do something like with a...
Well, those all make noise, right? That's fine. Well, you know, those will all play.
I'm going to mute that because I don't want it to be like, I don't want to blow anybody's ears out.
A bigger problem, what movie do we do for 50? What movie could compete? What is special enough for a 50th show? Or do we do like a clip show?
Yes. So clip shows, again, kind of hard, especially because there's only two of us and we would need at least probably one or two more people to go through, listen to things, mark them off and let us know.
Yes, that's the main problem of both for Zero Hit Points and Book Club for Movies is that we would need two or three other people to listen.
And that's just not happening right now. We can't ask any of you to do that.
Also,
kind of
there's
thing.
No way I'd have enough time to do anything extra for. So what do we do?
What do we do
for 50?
What is a momentous film that we've never talked about? Maybe
should we open it up to the two or three listeners?
Sure. If anybody's got a suggestion, I'd love to hear it.
All right, we'll give it some thought.
Yeah.
Off mic, we do that. But you give it some thought too and let us know. Podcast at bookclubformovies.com. Again, also Facebook, Twitter, whatever you want. Get at us in any way. What do we do for 50? Movie or otherwise. I'm open to kind of whatever. It doesn't take as much time as a clip show.
Yeah, I would love some suggestions. It'd be fun. Okay. I think we're done. Well, let's just go to the rest of the show.
Okay, yeah. At the very least, we got more to talk about today. What else have you watched this week, Matt?
Oh my goodness gracious. I have so many movies to talk about.
You have the movies. Oh, no.
I have three.
Oh, that's not so bad.
One of them will be very quick. The other two might be quick. Who knows? The first movie I watched is called The Proposition, written by Nick Cave, directed by John Hillcoate of The Road fame, by the way. Starring Guy Pearce, Ray Winstone, Emily Watson, Noah Taylor, and Richard Wilson. John Hillcoate also, by the way, directed the, if you remember when Red Dead Redemption came out, they did a short movie that used all the in-game footage.
Oh,
They did a short movie and he directed that too.
I did not know that.
Huh. Yeah.
Also fun to say, Hillcoate.
Hillcoate. Yeah, and autocorrect tries to change it to Hellcat. So I think either way.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
We should let him know about that.
The Proposition is a Western taking place in Australia. Is written by Nick Cave, who, if you've never listened to Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, I recommend go listen to him. If you've seen Hellboy, okay, you have accidentally heard them because the song that he is probably best known for is a song called Red Right Hand. Kind of works out for Hellboy. Great song. Fantastic musician. he is a relatively dark musician in terms of what they write, what he sings about, what he writes about. He has had a very, like, a weirdly tragic life. His son died very young. All sorts of weird stuff. Guy is an incredible writer. He was actually tapped by Russell Crowe. After Gladiator came out, Russell Crowe talked to him, and somebody else from the studio said, "We want you to write the sequel." His response was, "The dude is dead." They said, "Figure it out." His sequel, the arc that he had, followed Maximus into the afterlife, where he had to go through hell to come back to help his family in like another giant war. I don't know. Sounded amazing. Nick Cave's great. This is a Western, takes place in Australia. Nick Cave is an Australian, so that's why. It takes place in the 1900s, 1800s, something like that. I'm not even sure what it's Old West. People with guns and they're hanging people.
Now, is it just the setting that's translated? Is there some like spiritual successorness to it? Or does it literally tackle the frontier of Australia at that time?
It is. It's not about that. It's about a specific... So this is a very... It's a small film that just takes place in that time. And so these three brothers that are in a gang, and they're the Burns brothers. And that's Danny Houston, Guy Pearce, and Richard Wilson. Richard Wilson being the youngest of the three. The movie starts off with them killing and raping a family. And the youngest of the three is not involved in it. He's there, but he's not involved so much. And Guy Pearce's character is not as involved either, especially with the rape. That's really the brother and the rest of the gang are involved in kind of that stuff. So they are going to be, they're the Ray Winstone shows up. He's got them cornered. The brother has now taken off. So Danny Houston's character is off in the, like in the outback somewhere in the hills, in the mountains. And what it comes down to is Ray Winstone makes a proposition to Guy Pearce. He says, "You go get your brother by Christmas, 9 days from now. I want him dead, and you and your brother can leave. You and your brother are pardoned."
So if he goes and kills his brother can leave?
Correct. If he kills his brother, Guy Pearce kills Danny Houston. Guy Pearce and Richard Wilson are pardoned.
Both go away free. Oh, yes. Gotcha. Okay.
They're able, even after the murder and the rape, they're going to be free to go. Guy Pearce leaves. His brother is stuck in a jail cell. His brother is assumed to be a little like special needs. Like he's challenged in some way
of mice and men thing going on here.
Yeah. But not quite as pointed as that.
Okay.
Ray Winstone's mentioned that he might be simple, but it's never defined. So Guy Pearce goes out, they leave the young brother alone in the jail cell. It gets out to locals and to somebody above Ray Winstone that he's made this proposition. And so they decide they're going to 100 lashes to the brother, which is going to kill him. Guy Pearce doesn't know it's happening. He's not aware of this yet because he's gone. He's finding his brother. This all comes to a head. Guy Pearce finds his brother. They come back. And by the way, Ray Winstone's character knows if this kid is lashed, he and his wife are going to be killed. He knows they're dead. It's a death sentence for them. The kid gets lashed. Things go as you kind of expect to a point. It is a mean movie. This is a mean movie. Like Green Room is a mean movie. Like Blue Ruin can be a mean movie. There is nothing like it can be very harsh to watch. And there are a couple of like really good / bad gore moments. Guy gets his head like straight up blown off. It's pretty cool.
Guy Pearce gets his head blown off?
No, a guy, not the guy.
Okay. All right.
every moment of this movie is very purposeful. There are so many beautiful shots from the Australian outback. Lots of silhouetted shots. Just fantastic look to the movie. When they're in the town, it's this wonderful, like there's a little bit of that grain to it, that grit to it. But you don't get the town a lot, which is kind of great. And when you do, it's really just like one little tiny section. Whether or not that was because that's what they could afford to build or not, I don't know. But it works really well. And then one of my favorite parts is that because Ray Winstone and his wife, Emily Watson, are they're transplants. His house is this immaculate, beautiful thing with a white picket fence and these beautiful garden in the middle of a desert that's in the nice. Middle of nowhere. And it's this perfect like encapsulation of who those people want to be and what they think they are. And then you get him and he's just always, always sweaty and dusty and covered in grime and grit and dirt. And it's this really, really great defined split between who they are and who, like, not only who they are together, who they are as a couple. And then,
visual,
you know,
storytelling.
Absolutely. Guy Pearce is incredible. This movie is fantastic. If you like Westerns at all, I highly recommend it. The part at the beginning that I did mention with like the murder and the rape, it's really very, 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 it's like it shows in flashes. You're more told about it than shown anything. So
smart.
Good movie. Really good movie. Okay. Very solid.
Proposition accepted.
Yeah. I followed that one up with, I think, a movie that I don't know how. You know, you follow up the proposition and it's got to be something that's really going to be strong. You know, you can't follow up a dramatic tour de force without something as strong. So the movie the next movie I want to mention is My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Okay.
Written by Nia Vardalos, directed by Joel Zwick, starring Nia Vardalos, John Corbett, Lainey Kazin, and Joey Fatone, which, by the way, I like that Fatone is Fat One, if you split it up.
This is, everybody knows.
I'd never seen this movie, and my wife wanted to, she was just looking for something, and she said, I never saw it, turn it on. And I wasn't even in the room when it started. I sat down like 5 minutes, and I'm like, I've never wanted to see this movie in my life. Zero interest in it. At the end of this movie, I was like, I'll watch this movie again because that was super funny. That is a shockingly great little movie. Maybe not shockingly because it's been out for like a decade.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, it is a fun, light little thing that I'm not sure I like that I haven't watched in a while. So I could be wrong.
I like it. I think it's really fun. It's very sweet. I think Nia Vardalos is very talented. I think that was it. I've obviously never seen anything else she's done because I've, you know, this is the only thing. But
what else had, I mean, besides the sequel,
which I obviously haven't seen, but I don't know anything else that she's
written.
Of
another movie, yeah,
that she's written. So I don't know, but very talented for the movie. She was great in the movie. Really fun. Like that movie. Nothing else to say about it at all. Literally.
Well, it's got Northern Exposure in it too. He does pretty good.
Yeah. I used to live down the street from a part where they used to film some of Northern Exposure.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that is fairly northerly, I guess, yeah, although not Canada.
No, I was in Seattle at the time.
Hmm.
Last movie I've got is Free Fire. It was written by Ben Wheatley and Amy Jump, directed by Ben Wheatley, starring Charlotte Copley, Cillian Murphy, Brie Larson. Yeah, what's up, Captain Marvel? I'll watch you in something better. And Armie Hammer.
Free Fire.
You don't have to pay for sense. It. It's Free okay. Fire.
Smart.
I've seen this movie a few times and I wanted to rewatch it because Beth had never seen it and she walked away going, yeah, that was a pretty fun movie.
I've never heard of it.
Number one, Ben Wheatley. Just Google Ben Wheatley. Watch every movie he's ever made because they're all really good. High Rise, I don't know what I watched, but I still love it. And that's got Loki
Ben
in it.
Wheatley.
So Ben Wheatley.
Kill List.
Kill List is so good.
Down Terrace
is pretty good too. Sightseers is one of my favorites.
Sightseers.
Like Sightseers a lot. That All was right. a fun, weird little horror movie. Kind
I've
of.
Not heard of any of these.
Yeah,
aside from his Doctor Who TV episodes.
So Ben Wheatley, terrific writer, terrific director. He's one of those guys that I will absolutely check out anything he's doing. So Free Fire is a comedy action-y thing. All of his movies kind of have a weird humorous tilt. More often than not, it's a little bit of a dark humor. This one's kind of straightforward in what it is. So this is a really smart movie because the movie all takes place outside of the very beginning in one location. And the location is a warehouse on a dock inside, totally interior. So this is fantastic because they're easily able to put this set together. And the way this is set up, just it's almost too perfect. But on the same token, you kind of go, okay, well, I could see this kind of laying out like this. So Free Fire is you've got Cillian Murphy and his group of friends. And Cillian Murphy is a weapons buyer. He's going to go buy a bunch of guns. Charlotte Copley is a weapons dealer. He also likes guns.
This is checking out so far.
Armie Hammer and Brie Larson are kind of the go-betweens. So Brie Larson gets Cillian Murphy to come to the deal. Armie Hammer brings Charlton Copley and his folks to the deal. They meet up. Armie Hammer, Charlton Copley, and Brie Larson all know each other. Cillian Murphy and his crew don't know any of these people other than Brie Larson and somewhat know Armie Hammer. It's not nearly as confusing as it sounds. There's like some familiarity here. The entire purpose of this movie is a weapons deal that goes really poorly because two guys got into a fight the night before in a bar over because one guy hit. It doesn't matter. They got into a fight. Those two guys end up being in the respective crews. That turns into this whole gunfight. So you have an entire gunfight in this warehouse. The best part of this movie is like within the first like 3 minutes of the gunfight, every single person's been shot at least once. So then it's them yelling at each other, talking to each other, screaming about what they're going to do, trying to make deals to get out of this. And it is a fantastic just cluster of actors, dialogue, visuals, and it blows by. This movie kicks fast. It's like an hour 30 and it just sails by. Every main actor that you've heard of in this movie, it, absolutely great. They all if anybody takes a hit in this movie, it's maybe Cillian Murphy for just being too Cillian Murphy, where he's like, hey, look at my big beautiful lips. This is a fantastic movie. I love it in so many respects. There is at least a little bit of a love letter to Reservoir Dogs in this one too. Absolutely 110% worth a watch. Super fun. Really fun movie, and Brie Larson is awesome in this movie. She's way better than Captain Marvel.
It's educated guess you're saying here.
Well, I mean, this movie's better than any comic book movie. So, I mean, no.
Okay.
Not educated.
Whoa,
just straight up comic
words,
book movies
wow.
suck. I really like this movie. I do. I highly recommend it. Armie Hammer is absolutely delightful in this flick. And Charlton Copley is... I feel like that's a guy, you either like him or you just don't. And I like him. I always think he's fun. And you know what's cool about this movie? I don't think any of them actually change their accents. Like, you actually, like, he...
Oh, really?
He keeps his South African accent. Like, it's great.
Cool.
It's a cool movie. That's all I've got.
Well, possibly I also watch some movies that are better than comic book movies, but I don't... It's such a loaded term now, I feel like.
Better than Tank Girl? Highly doubtful.
Oh, man. Okay. You just threw it all up in... We talked about this last week, too. I mentioned it. The Karate Kids.
Yes. I was going to try and watch those, and then I forgot about it.
Yeah. You've seen them.
But I can promise you I remember every single thing about the first movie.
So the first movie is... I mean, there are a lot of 80s movies that are really 80s movies. I think The Karate Kid might be the most 80s movie.
And yet it still holds up.
Oh, no, it totally holds up. It's just, it's amazing how much, like, there's little, when I think of 80s movies, I think of, like, little kind of nothing interactions that are huge deals. Like, okay, there's a scene in the first Karate Kid where Elizabeth, number one, has Elizabeth Shue and Ralph Macchio, so I don't know, it's already the most 80s movie, even back then. They're like, this is pretty 80s.
If you want to know what makes it the most 80s movie, it's neither of them. It's the fact that William Billy Zabka is the bad guy.
Okay. True. But there's this scene where they're literally just on the soccer field, and I want to say one of them walks up to the other with the soccer ball, and they're like, ha, 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 ha. And they like throw the soccer ball around a little bit, and that's it. It's just so happy.
Well, you had to establish that he's a fun, athletic kind of guy, kind of, before, you know, the Cobra Kai guys come over and beat him up.
It's just so emblematic, I feel like, of that entire decade. Like, I'm going to get really absurd here, possibly, but there was a reason why I think John Hughes is, like, the king, because he would take moments like that, and he made teenagers into real people, right? Whereas rest of the movies that were just killing it mostly had interactions like this, where it's just like, ha ha, like, it's not terribly far removed from the football tossing scene in The Room, right? You can look it up on YouTube.
You don't have to. if you've ever thrown a rock at a wall, you know what that scene is.
A rock act in a movie.
That's right. Or the rock, act in a movie. Yeah, no, okay. I don't know.
Maybe also the rock. Yeah.
I think that what you're saying here, by the way, John Hughes is and still is, I think, in many respects, the exception to a rule. And I think it's something that we've been talking about and has been talked about forever. And I think is getting more and more attention because the internet exists and because making a movie is, quote unquote, 10 times easier than it has been ever in the past. Sure. It's way easier. Is getting natural dialogue from kids and teenagers.
Oh, yeah.
It's really, really hard, especially because so much stuff, like language, gets stuck in a decade.
Yeah, like imagine a 50-year-old trying to write a script for a speaking 12-year-old or 16-year-old.
At
any time. Yeah.
I'm almost 40. I still say rad. You know how many people say rad now? Not a lot. And when they they're talking about radiation or fallout. Either way.
And not Fallout 76, which is explicitly not rad.
But it's also radiation. Yes. I think that's a main thing. It is writing teenagers is really hard. And you know, you like Bo Burnham knocked it out of the park writing.
I heard
teenagers.
About that movie. Have you seen it?
Yeah. Out of the park. Like is it that good? Is, okay. Yeah, that's a movie that you're like, yeah, he understands, but he's also young. Like he's also relatively close in age. John Hughes was the guy who was like, maybe he wasn't close in age, but he knew how to do it. He knew how to basically take teenagers and say, okay, you're adults. You're just slightly dumber adults.
That's the trick, everybody. Wow. You just distilled it. The Karate Kid, there's just an earnestness to that decade that can't be recreated outside of it. Very rarely is. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but The Karate Kid is that, but also legitimately good at the same time. There's that moment in the middle of the movie where Daniel's son finds all of Mr. Miyagi's war memorabilia while he's kind of passed out drunk on the couch.
It's
a beautiful moment, like regardless of any of the other trappings of this film. Like it's just a really cool piece of movie.
I actually think, and there aren't a ton of them, but I think most of the sequences where it's not about the actual, like where Daniel's not trying
karate.
To learn karate.
Yeah.
But when it's the one-on-ones with Miyagi, those are amazing sequences. Like those are really well done.
That's the stuff. The karate really takes a back seat. I mean, it really takes a back seat and we'll just keep going. Karate Kid 2. But in a way that I feel like was because they understood what made the first one great.
Right.
You know, like they take the Miyagi stuff. They concentrate on him as a character. They go to Japan. They deal with very reverently. In fact, like
they go to Okinawa.
Yeah, they're in Okinawa. They talk about Shinto. There's like a really, again, it's not necessarily subtle, but good thread about industrialization and how this the village that they're in is kind of get taken over by the antagonist, who is this guy from Miyagi's past that got the girl or could have. Because Miyagi, watch the movie. It's a good movie. That whole story, they bring in the history, they bring in World War. Like, it's really well done.
It is really well done.
More so than it has any right to be.
And that movie, to my memory, I haven't seen that one recently, but I did see it not too long ago. That movie, by memory, too, had really, really nice locations. Like that.
It's
like
gorgeous. All, it's looks shot like it's, beautifully. I mean, yeah, the first one is too, but.
No, but I remember the second one because like I feel like they actually shot it in Okinawa or they shot it not.
That's true. I guess I don't really know, but I would believe it.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they shot it. They probably shot it in Hawaii.
No, it looks really good. It runs into problems towards the end. Like you can kind of see where some executive probably said, "Well, it's got to have more karate than this in it, or it's got to have like a contest to build towards or something like that." Because the way the story shakes out is that there's Miyagi's businessman enemy guy also has students and they want to fight Daniel's son. Yeah. So
it's the Okinawan Cobra Kai.
Yes, it is.
Except this time the crane kick does not work.
It does not. But also that entire sequence does not, like, they figured they had to end it in some sort of karate contest, and that kind of sucks because there's basically two endings now, the real one of which has the contest falling apart and because the weather picks up and people's actual lives are at stake and people sacrifice each other to rescue others and everybody comes together in that moment and realizes how stupid they've been. Like, that's what they should have sidelined the entire karate for, you know, that, sure, that could have been a really strong finish, but, you know, audiences wouldn't have bought it or wanted to see him win in a contest at the end or something like that. Like, you can kind of see maybe that's what happened. Karate Kid Part 3, I think.
Are you done with that already? Did we already finish?
Starts with a note that says, well, that's too bad. And I've seen these before. I guess I knew this was coming, but yeah, Karate Kid Part 3 is...
It just kind of happened and shouldn't have.
The biggest bummer sequels to me are ones that not only forget why the originals were good, but they kind of depend on regression.
Right.
And in this one, Daniel completely regresses to, like, you know, problems that were solved in the first movie.
Sure.
You could say. And I think it's a bummer because there, I think there is, Karate Kid Part 2 actually does do this, but there is a story to be had about him still coming of age, but just at a different phase in life, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This, I don't know if they tried to do that or what, or somebody somewhere understood that, but it's like the villain is way more of a caricature than it's ever been. That might actually be bad, good, funny at that point. But for the most part, it just completely depends on Daniel being a worse person.
Who played him? Who played the villain?
Oh, it's the dude with the ponytail. I mean, they bring Kreese back for a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that.
And that's doesn't like side, get, like they bring Kreese him back die? To say that he died. Yeah, 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 yeah. But no, it's I couldn't tell you the name of the dude. I haven't seen him in anything since either. But he's so over the top in the way he plays everything.
That's right, Thomas Ian Griffith.
That's yeah, probably that- him.
And you have absolutely seen him. He was in freaking Triple X. He was in one of the Triple X movies.
What? Was he really? Okay. That yeah. makes perfect sense, actually. You know what? Somebody saw Karate Kid Part 3 and said, oh, he belongs in a Triple X movie. And they nailed it.
He was also in the movie Vampires, which was a mediocre John Carpenter movie that I like a lot.
Oh, one of those.
Yeah. But you also,
that also fits, though, really.
But also, he was in two episodes of Wise Guy, so there's that.
Okay. He's not very wise in this movie.
Get me to the swankiest of Karate Kids.
The next Karate Kid is not as bad as the Karate Kid Part 3.
Correct.
But also, I don't think at the end is a loving recreation, really. I think you said it best when you said, Hilary Swank is fun.
Yeah.
Last week.
Yeah. Hilary Swank is fun.
It's, you know what it does set a record for? Speaking of 80s movies, it sets two records. Number one, for older actors playing teenagers. Like, everybody in this film is like 40 years old.
Sure.
It's nuts. Hilary Swank might be the one that pulls it off the best. I guess that's good. But everybody else looks like they're Mr. Miyagi's age, basically. So,
and Mr. Miyagi still looks like he was the same age from the first one.
True. And the story doesn't do it any favors. Like, there's like a military organization that exists within the school somehow.
Sure.
I mean, it's headed up by Michael Ironsides, so I don't know.
Well, and you know, he's the best.
Bonus, or at least appropriate.
Yeah. Michael Ironside loses his arms in a lot of movies.
He does. That's true. Not this one. Although I guess his arm does get kind of handicapped at one point.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure. It's just weird. It's like they had these ideas and didn't adjust any of the setting. I mean, they don't.
I feel like the main difference between her and Daniel was the fact that she was like somewhat affluent. Didn't she live in a big house in like the
suburbs?
She did.
And also she started off in a way worse spot. Like, her father had died and she was kind of railing against the world. And which is the other record that gets set here is for awkward 80s situations. Like, Mr. Miyagi was friends with her father in the war. So he's also a family friend, but he goes to their house and the mom, who can't handle the daughter anymore, Hilary Swank, is like, what if, or I think Mr. Miyagi suggests it, which actually makes this worse. He's like, what if you just went and lived in my house for a while and I lived in your house for a while? And she's like, okay.
That sounds good.
Which is...
Wait, Walton Goggins was in that?
Yeah, Walton Goggins is in it too.
Also, by the way, for the fact that that movie made weird 80s things and was made in 1994 really tells you something.
they're using weird 80s tropes in the 90s and they're just not working
maybe
anymore.
This movie should have been made in the 80s.
But yeah, the situation is just becomes weird. They definitely want it to be like a father-daughter thing, but he's only known her for like seconds and has all these like really touching scenes where she's become a woman. And I'm like, that just makes it weirder, man. So I don't know, but Michael Ironsides gets it in the end. No, in the end, man, you know what happens in the end? In the end, you have, by some weird confluence of events, again, it's like they didn't consider what was actually happening because they knew they had to have some sort of scene in the end. What it becomes is nonsensical to absurd at worst, where Mr. Miyagi is yelling at Hilary Swank in the middle of a street fight to basically finish it.
Miyagi was, do you remember Shang Tsung can take on other people's forms?
Oh, okay. Now it does make sense that it came out in the 90s. And
man, if the next Mortal Karate Kombat Kid movie actually had Mortal Kombat tinges, movie would be amazing.
It actually does, Matt. That final scene, like they're at a dock. You know, they went down to the docks.
Sure.
Where, and by the way, she has a boyfriend in this movie where it would have been really cool if she could have rescued him. She kind of does that here because he gets his butt kicked before she shows up. But it's not like a fun, you know, flipping the whole damsel in distress on its head type thing. It's just she shows up at the place. Mr. Miyagi condones the dock fight, Fred, and takes part in it later on out of nowhere. And then when she is, you know, he's literally just, it's not a contest. You know, this is not a contest atmosphere where he's watching Danielson and he's getting kicked down and he's like, you know, believe in yourself. It's a street fight with barrels and cars on fire around them. It literally is Mortal Kombat.
Well, it sounds more like Street Fighter 2. Okay, did they punch the cars? True.
No, they just lit it on fire. Stupid. They were lazy. They could have punched a car to explode and this would have been a better movie. That's true about most movies though.
Fair.
The Karate Kids, everybody. You've seen them. Go watch them again, I guess. I don't know.
Sure.
Book Club for Movies, everybody. You've heard it. Go listen to it again.
Yeah, make suggestions for us. Send us Twitters and podcasts. Let us know what you want for the 50th big episode.
There you go.
5-0. If you don't pick something, it's probably going to end up having Diane Wiest in it.
It'll be, well, number one, cool. But number two, it'll be your fault. We're putting it all on you.
We're going to watch Parenthood, the movie.
That is a movie.
Yeah, it's great.
Steve.
Harvey.
Harvey.
Steve Perry.
Martin?
I thought we said no more Journey psychouts.
I never said that.
Yes. Steve Martin, Diane Wiest, Tom Hulce, Keanu Reeves, Martha
Keanu
Plimpton.
Reeves?
He changed his name to Joaquin Leaf Phoenix.
Oh, no. Matt, Parenthood is making some sort of good amount of sense for our 50th show now.
It's Rick Moranis is in it.
Oh,
Harley
no.
Jane Kozak.
You sealed it.
It is a comedy. It has lots of comedy elements. It's also very much a dramedy. Like it actually deals with really interesting stuff. As a kid, I like the movie. As a parent, the movie is poignant in a lot of ways. Like it really does touch on so many things as a parent that you kind of deal with or have to deal with or may understand and somebody else has dealt with. And you kind of, it's,
so for our 50th episode, we are going to do the movie that will most likely, most often, make us sound like 50-year-olds.
It could. I think we should still take suggestions.
Okay, all right.
If we get nothing, we'll do Parenthood.
Only you can prevent us from doing Parenthood next week, everybody.
Yeah.
Get into it.
Book Club for Movies, not podcast. At org.